That's the great voice and music of Hugh Masekela, a song titled Timlela. This is Lead Stories. I'm Eutrice Lead, and today a program that follows the same theme that we began this week with, which is, of course, the U.S. Supreme Court. And I've been talking about the fact that when people talk of the U.S. Supreme Court, they assume that there's only one history to it, and it's the history they write. Very seldom do we see the historical record reflecting the other reality, which, of course, in many cases, is the real reality. And such is the case with the U.S. Supreme Court. As we witness the debacle going on with regard to the choosing of an associate justice for an empty seat on the U.S. Supreme Court, we see things that we just can't imagine we would be seeing. Tawdry topics are surfacing, and people are talking about the U.S. Supreme Court in a way that we never imagined, nor are we comfortable with, as a matter of fact. But it is the reality of the racial bifurcation, if you will, of the United States, and that goes way back in history. I have a guest to share with you today, share with us, and this is his area of specialty. He is a historian of slavery, capitalism, and African-American inequality. He is a professor at Arizona State University and has written many books and scholarly papers and essays and articles on issues relating to slavery. Among the books are Unrequited, this is the current one, Unrequited Toil, A History of United States Slavery, The Business of Slavery and the Rise of American Capitalism from 1815 to 1860, Money Over Mastery, Family Over Freedom, Slavery in the Antebellum Upper South, and a long-lost autobiography by Henry Goings, Rambles of a Runaway from Southern Slavery. He also is preparing his next work, Disinherited, Dispossessed, and Decapitalized, The Limits of Black Wealth in America from 1619 to 2019. His name is Calvin Schermerhorn, and I have a little quip here to share with you. When I first came to New York, and I was trying to get my way around, and I had this appointment, and I was running late, pretty tight on time, and I found that I couldn't navigate downtown Brooklyn as well as I thought I would have been able to with public transportation, and the appointment was to be held on Schermerhorn Street. Okay. So I kept asking people, where is Schermerhorn Street? And nobody seemed to know. And then I finally ran into somebody with a sympathetic face, and I was just at my wit's end because I'd wasted so much time trying to find Schermerhorn Street. And that's when I discovered that in Brooklyn, it's called Schermerhorn. I was looking for Schermerhorn Street, according to my fellow Brooklynites. So with that, Professor Calvin Schermerhorn, I welcome you to Lead Stories, and I'm looking forward to our discussion today.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be on.
Thank you. How do you feel about the proper pronunciation of your name, according to Brooklynites?
I'll defer to the Brooklynites. I'm from a poor branch of this family that moved west in the 19th century. But I know on the A and B trains, it's even more compressed. It's Schermerhorn.
Skimbrin. Well, you've been writing these essays, and I was intrigued when I read your most recent one, having to do with the history of the Supreme Court as a way of getting us into the discussion of the flip side, or the unknown side and unknown history of the U.S. Supreme Court and its role in maintaining an apartheid society, and oddly enough, spawning and the structuring of society in specifically capitalist terms. What do you make of what is going on now, the debacle that we're witnessing? What is it saying to you that the nation, even as it professes to be deeply involved in being transparent, is actually deliberately hiding very important history about this particular institution?
Yes. So this is instead of being unique or distinctive, the current nomination debacle is reminiscent of a politicized court that's been acting since the beginning of the judiciary in the 1790s. And that is to say that presidents have always nominated candidates who reflect their political strategies, who are willing to go and enact their political strategies. And often that has meant putting justices forward who have no qualifications, or whose qualifications are that they are partisan warriors, and that this this process, the confirmation process, is, in Justice Elena Kagan's words, a vapid and hollow charade. It's meant to endorse the will of the president and the president's party, and there's very little room, or there has been very little room in this process of nominating Supreme Court justices for the elevation of jurists who are dedicated solely to principle. Having said that, what we're seeing in this particular nomination is justifiably called hyperpartisanship, which is to say that it seems that there has been an effort to conceal the nominee's records by withholding hundreds of thousands of pages of his record, and also what we saw on display last week, which is a rushed nomination that seems to blow up in scandal, and then is followed by a pretense at an FBI investigation, which might have been done beforehand. But let me confine my perspectives to history, and to say that there is plenty of precedent for this, going right back to the start. I mean, Thomas Jefferson famously said that the federal judiciary was a hospital of decayed politicians. And that's John Randolph. Thomas Jefferson said that the Federalists have retired to the judiciary, from which stronghold they will batter down all the works of republicanism. And what he meant by that was that after the rival party Federalists had lost the 1800 elections, they attempted to pack the courts, the federal courts, with Federalists who would serve for life, and even tried to expand the Supreme Court, or actually to contract the Supreme Court, so that that Jefferson's party wouldn't be able to pick successors. And so the Jefferson party fought back. They actually impeached a sitting associate justice, Samuel Chase of Maryland. They also impeached and removed a federal judge from Timothy Pickering of Massachusetts, who was perhaps mentally ill, who'd also give drunken screeds from the bench. So they got rid of one judge. They almost got rid of a Supreme Court judge. And here was, you know, this is in the first decade of the 19th century, well over 200 years ago. And it's you see this process happening in time.
Well, could you undertake the task of giving us a tour, if you will, a historical tour of the issue of the U.S. Supreme Court, being born in the crucible of slavery and white supremacy, and whose task, it seemed, it was intended to enshrine those values and attitudes in the so-called laws of the land. How, in what instances could you point to where the U.S. Supreme Court was clearly an agent, it was an instrument of oppression?
Sure. There are several Supreme Court cases in the 19th century in which the federal government upheld enslavers' rights over against over against African Americans' freedoms. The most famous was in 1857 in a case called Dred Scott v. Sanford. And this was a case concerning a freedom suit by Dred Scott, who was born enslaved in Virginia in 1795. He was taken by an owner into a free territory. He lived in Missouri for a time, and in the 1840s, encouraged by some abolitionists, he sued for his freedom in state courts in Missouri under the with the argument that having been on free soil, he deserved his freedom. And after a legal battle, he won. He won the case, but his new owner appealed, and the Supreme Court took this case, and it took this case for a very political and politicized reason, which was that the country was coming apart over the issue of slavery in the territories and enslavers' demands that enslaved property, that is, fugitives, from slavery be returned. And so the court decided in 1857, shortly after a presidential election and the nomination of James Buchanan, that Dred Scott did not have any right to his freedom. In fact, he didn't have standing to sue because he was not a citizen of Missouri and he was not a citizen of the United States. And then Chief Justice Roger B. Taney, whose background I can talk about, went further. He actually went much further. He said that not only did Dred Scott not have standing to sue and that he was not a citizen, but that no African-descended Americans were citizens. He said in his ruling, he found, and I quote, that African-Americans, well, I'll quote, the Negro has no rights which the white man was bound to respect, and that the Negro might justifiably and lawfully be reduced to slavery for his own benefit. And to arrive at this extraordinary decision, he actually used what we might call originalist thinking. He went back to the Declaration of Independence and to the jurisprudence of the founders of the American Republic, and decided that since they imported Africans as slaves, as enslaved people, that they never intended for any descendants of those people to be U.S. citizens. And by that originalist argument, he was able to categorically exclude African Americans from citizenship. He wasn't done. After he did that, he said that Congress also had no power to restrict slavery in any United States territory. And this effectively nullified the Missouri Compromise of 1820. The Missouri Compromise of 1820 had been repealed by the Kansas-Nebraska Act of 1854, but this put the nail in the coffin of any federal law barring slavery in any U.S. territory. Now, this was a blatantly political decision. It was supposed to stop the political bleeding by using the prestige of a high court that was supposed to be an impartial arbiter of American law and constitutionality in the service of a very partisan political issue. And in the run-up to this decision, the soon-to-be inaugurated President James Buchanan actually colluded with at least one justice, so that the ultimate 7-2 ruling in Dred Scott had at least one Northerner on board. Even though the Taney Court was composed primarily of Southerners and enslavers. So So this was not actually overturned by the 13th Amendment. It had to be overturned by the 14th Amendment in the late 1860s after the Civil War. But quite a bit had changed since then.
Well, one could argue that this case is a seminal case also because it, quote, decided other matters as to who is a citizen, who is not, and the business of natural rights versus negotiated rights or permitted rights. Whites obviously having natural rights, and others, particularly Africans in America and people of color generally, having to negotiate on a case by case basis, whatever it is they would be permitted to think of as their rights.
Yes. Yes. And this is a shrewd point, because what Dred Scott did was to say that the default setting in American law, let's say, is that African descended people are not citizens, right? And so you have to use, and if you have that as your default, right, if that's what the law reverts to in the absence of other positive law, in terms of statutes, in terms of other kind of expressly articulated assertions of universal rights or universal citizenship, then this is a problem, right? Because what happened after the Civil War, in terms of the 13th Amendment abolishing chattel slavery, except as a consequence of being convicted of a crime, or the 14th Amendment, passed in 1868, which stated that no state shall make or enforce any law which shall abridge the privileges and immunities of citizens of the United States, deprive anyone of life, liberty, or property without due process of law, or deny the equal protections of the law. This starts to repair the damage of slavery and the racism that it institutionalizes. And so that pushes back against quite a bit of law, quite a bit of custom, a lot of social practices. And then the tragedy, the jurisprudential tragedy, is that after the American Civil War, you had a Supreme Court that was left to decide cases that were brought, that chipped away at things like the 13th and the 14th, and then the 15th Amendment, which guaranteed the right to vote regardless of a previous condition of servitude or race. It did just say that men had the right to vote. We'd have to wait quite a while for a woman's right to vote. So the Reconstruction era court actually acted as a conservative break on the forces of emancipation. And to kind of drill down and make that more comprehensible, what you had in the Lincoln and the Grant administrations, that is during and right after the Civil War, were a group of justices who were nominated and confirmed based on two presidential strategies. Abraham Lincoln replaced the court over which Roger B. Taney presided with a court that was friendly to his presidential powers to wage a civil war and reunite the Union. And well and good. But he did make appointments that had the long-term consequences of counteracting that. So in 1862, while he was considering the Emancipation Proclamation, Lincoln nominated Samuel F. Miller of Iowa to the Supreme Court. He did this because the U.S. justice system had just added the Tenth Circuit. This was the first circuit west of the Mississippi River. Miller was from Iowa. Lincoln presumed that he would be responsible for the Tenth Circuit. He had actually owned enslaved people at one time. He'd manumitted them. He'd set them free. He'd moved to Iowa. But Lincoln missed a chance to ask Miller what he thought about black freedom, what he thought was the extent of African-American rights and liberties. In fact, Lincoln never even met with Miller before he appointed him to the Supreme Court. And Miller's biographer claims that he sought results first and then found the arguments to justify them. So Lincoln was sure that Miller would endorse his war powers, but when it came to deciding constitutional cases that had bearings on civil rights, Miller fell in a majority that narrowed the scope of the 14th Amendment that ensured civil rights. And so this came in the 1873 slaughterhouse cases, which was a 5-4 decision. And the decision was actually about the ability of a state, Louisiana, to grant a monopoly to certain slaughterhouses. But the ramifications were, for this decision, was to narrow the scope of the 14th Amendment. And so here was Lincoln's contribution to the Supreme Court. I mean, Lincoln picked many justices, but this is one of those who made a critical decision. And then Lincoln's successor, Ulysses Grant, also nominated justices that pushed forth the Republican Party's pro-business agenda. And you could say, well, he's the president. He's presiding over a party that was in bed with railroad interests and banking interests. But the effect of Grant's shaping the Supreme Court was that by the 1870s, the newly created Justice Department had one arm enforcing federal civil rights laws, but the Grant-appointed Supreme Court was undoing them at the same time. So here's an example. In 1870, Grant appointed a pro-business Republican, Joseph P. Bradley, to the Supreme Court. And he did that for a specific reason, to decide a specific case. It was called the legal tender cases. The legal tender cases were about the ability of the government to issue greenbacks, that is, paper money, without any specific backing in gold or silver. In 1874, Grant picked another kind of a crony of his Ohio friends, Morrison Waite, W-A-I-T-E. And Morrison Waite had zero judicial experience. When Grant picked him, you know, the telegram arrived, and Waite couldn't believe it. But he was politically well-connected. Senate confirmed him without debate. And so this is well and good for railroad interests and banking interests, but in 1873... in April, in Grant Parish, Louisiana, a white supremacist sheriff's posse engaged in a pitched battle with an elected African-American white coalition sheriff's office sheriff's posse in what would become the Colfax Massacre. And over this Easter weekend in 1873, up to 150 African Americans were shot, murdered. One participant in this, William or Bill Cruikshank, lined up two African American men and tried to shoot them both in the head with the same bullet, realizing that no state court in Louisiana would convict him of murder. Now, Cruikshank was indicted under a federal civil rights violation. And he and 37 other men were convicted in the Colfax Massacre under the Enforcement Act of 1870, which put teeth in the 14th Amendment. It made it a federal crime to violate someone's civil rights because murder was a state charge. Cruikshank and his lawyers tested the political winds and decided to appeal these convictions, and they appealed them all the way to the Supreme Court. And in 1876, the U.S. Supreme Court heard the case of U.S. v. Cruikshank. And in that case, Bradley, this Grant appointee, wrote that the U.S. had not clearly stated that the accused in slaughtering more than 100 black men had committed the acts complained of, in quotes, with a design to deprive the injured persons of their rights on account of their race, color, or previous condition of servitude. And so in that ruling, Judge Bradley said, in effect, unless the perpetrators, you know, scream out as they're firing their weapons that they are intending to kill people, to do this for a political reason because they are African American, then there's no crime. And for those listeners, I would urge them to read Adam Serwer's recent article on this in The Atlantic. And so Morrison Waite concurred. He wrote that this amendment guarantees nothing. The only obligation resting on the United States is to see that the states do not deny their rights. That is, that unless this is being, unless the Colfax massacre were committed by the state of Louisiana, then the individuals charged cannot be convicted. But this was willful blindness to the fact that this was a sheriff's posse. This was a political, this was an act of political terrorism. It was an act of political murder. But the Supreme Court then constricted the 14th Amendment. You might say strangled the 14th Amendment, and the writing was on the wall. This gave rise to the swift and violent reign of Jim Crow afterwards. This wasn't the sole case. The Supreme Court made many other rulings that kind of reinforced Jim Crow. Justice Bradley went on to rule in 1883 in the civil rights cases that the Civil Rights Act of 1875, the last gasp of Reconstruction, was unconstitutional. The Civil Rights Act of 1875 said you cannot discriminate against people in a movie theater. You cannot discriminate against people on public transportation or cemeteries, but it didn't use this language. It just said, in public accommodations. But in doing so, Justice Bradley said that African Americans, he didn't use that term, ceases the black citizen, he said, ceases to be the special favorite of the law. And this was at a time in which African Americans were being shot down in the streets, murdered with impunity, denied access to schools, denied access to restaurants, to public accommodations. Again, here's willful blindness. Several years later, the Supreme Court ruled in Plessy v. Ferguson that separate but equal was the doctrine, the law of the land. And it wouldn't be until 1957 that the U.S. Congress passed another Civil Rights Act.
We are encouraged to believe that all of these legal atrocities that you just discussed, you just laid out for us, they're in the past. The Supreme Court has grown up. It now understands its mission to be a kind of impartial arbiter of the law, as opposed to an agent of oppression and suppression of targeted groups and their rights. Would you argue that, in fact, the U.S. Supreme Court has grown up in this sense?
No. Supreme Courts change, and Supreme Courts are as good as the political conscience or the moral conscience of their leaders, and that's not necessarily the Chief Justice, but the Chief Justice decides which cases to hear. And so we may be lulled into thinking this when we think about Brown v. Board of Education, the unanimous 1954 decision ordering desegregation in public schools. So we may think about this in the heroic Loving v. Virginia case in 1967, which struck down anti-miscegenation laws, that is, that state laws that says that African Americans and whites cannot intermarry, or even Obergefell v. Hodges, which legalized same-sex marriage, and think, yes, the Supreme Court does not have to respond to electoral consequences. It's free to interpret the conscience of the legal rights and the greatest ideals of the U.S. Constitution. But those cases are few and far between. And so what we've seen recently, especially in the Roberts Court, which has been since 2005, is a very conservative court that defends against discrimination rhetorically, but hands down decisions that are very much like the Reconstruction courts in undermining civil rights. So you can think about the Shelby County v. Holder. This was a 2013 decision, a 5-4 decision, gutting the civil rights, the Voting Rights Act of 1965, by saying that in certain jurisdictions they no longer need any federal oversight. That will say that the lessons of the civil rights era have been learned, but this opened the door to voter suppression. And so this is a very clear case of the Supreme Court turning a blind eye to the potential and now the actual practice of denying the right to vote to people of color. You've got the decision in Citizens United that equated dollars with free speech that opened the door to dark money in politics. This is a very, it's supposed to expand the First Amendment, but instead it shifts the emphasis from the actual speech of people to the dollars funded, undisclosed dollars in many cases, funded to political action groups. This is not a direct assault, on civil rights, because you could still say, well, everyone's right to vote is still intact, theoretically at least. But then you have decisions like Bush v. Gore, another 5-4 decision, ordering recounts in some counties in Florida, but stopping a Florida-wide recount in the 2000 presidential election. And, of course, the decision was nakedly political, was described as political at the time. And very recently, you have decisions that have so far gone under the radar, but look at Epic Systems Corp. v. Lewis, a 2018 decision, another 5-4 decision. This is the first one, majority opinion written by Neil Gorsuch, and that is to say that an employer can require its employees to submit to individual arbitration of wage and hour and other working conditions complaints, rather than suing their employer in court or forming a class action suit. And so what this does is to gut Title VII of the Civil Rights Act of 1964. It nullifies or if not weakens or nullifies the National Labor Relations Act of 1935, because binding arbitration allows the company to pick the arbiter. And when you allow the company to pick the arbiter, you take the power, the presumed impartiality away from this arbitration. And so, while these decisions, you could say, leave in place theoretical rights, in practice, they favor the rights of corporations and favor they refuse to shield citizens from discrimination and from abuses.
How do you rate a U.S. Supreme Court emerging under the clear influence of a president about whom there's great concern, not only about his mental acuity, but his own personal standards and his record of in business of doing things, let's say, off-center? How does this Supreme Court look under the influence of Donald Trump?
Yeah, this is a good question. And I would even frame it in larger terms, which is that how do you trust a court that is the consequence of a process that doesn't seem fair, that seems nakedly partisan and lopsided, how do you trust the decisions of a court that by the admissions of some of its own members is not acting fairly? And that's going to cause a crisis of confidence in Supreme Court decisions. So if you and I go into a court and that the justice is wearing a red badge and you're wearing a blue badge, and you understand that that justice has already said that they do not trust, do not have any sympathy for anyone who wears a blue badge. You cannot expect impartiality. And if you cannot expect impartiality, if you just expect the justices to rule based on politics rather than the substance of the legal argument, then you will not go into that court. You will not abide by that court's ruling. And so what we can expect in this process is an erosion in the confidence in the Supreme Court and in the judiciary broadly. Fortunately, there's more than one jurisdiction, right? There's state courts and there's federal courts. There are courts of appeal. There are military courts. The Supreme Court is one of many. But the effect of such a highly partisan and politicized process is to undermine that confidence. And in part, you can see in the 19th century, a lack of confidence in the political process, a lack of confidence in institutions, actually precipitated the American Civil War. I'm not going to predict another civil war, since we're divided as people in groups and not in necessarily in geographic locations. But it doesn't bode well for American institutions.
I want to touch on a subject about which you have written prolifically, and that is the history of capitalism. And, of course, I would like you to address the role, or the likely role, of the U.S. Supreme Court in creating the rise of American capitalism, although based on slavery.
Yes. Thank you. Yes, the rise of American capitalism in the context of slavery. This was the idea that can I back up just a second? Because what I'd hoped that you would ask would be the kind of the current configuration of the court, but and its relationship to capitalism,
you can take it wherever you need to go.
Okay, well,
feel free.
So, okay, thank you. Well, so if we look at the history of the 20th century, something exceptional happened in the middle of the 20th century that hasn't happened before or since. And that is that as a consequence of the New Deal era, the United States, along with many other countries, attempted to manage capitalism. And it attempted to manage capitalism in favor of workers. And there was many facets to that. I mean, you could count immigration, you could count unionization, you could count Social Security, and also programs like the GI Bill, or the interstate highways, the federal home loan guarantees. Many of these adversely affected African Americans, but on the whole, wages went up, an American middle class was created, and the implicit deal was for corporations that you would submit, whether you're GM or a defense contractor, you would submit to a significant amount of government control and planning. You would be able to make profits as you sold more vehicles, sold more units, and you would tolerate unions and pay cost of living allowances and adjustments, pay health insurance, retirements, pensions. And this was kind of the mid-century capitalist consensus. Yes, there's big business. There is not an equitable, completely equitable distribution of wealth, but most Americans were happy, I guess, maybe I shouldn't use the term happy, were well off in their homes with their rising wages, with their job security, with their opportunities to at least see that their children have a better day. And this is where we see the rise of civil rights being affected in the Poor People's Campaign and the Jobs Campaign, in civil rights being accompanied with asking for at least the economic opportunity that everyone else was seemingly enjoying. And this changed in the 1970s with deregulation, with the collapse of the New Deal coalition. That is that conservative Democrats, especially in the South, left the party and joined the Republicans. And what you had beginning in the 1970s was a shift to re-marketized capitalism. And what you saw as an outcome of that was growing income inequality, growing wealth inequality. By 2016, white Americans have 10 times the wealth of African Americans in terms of median income, or median wealth, I'm sorry. And what we're seeing with recent Supreme Court decisions is an endorsement of that pattern to give fewer and fewer protections to workers, fewer and fewer government controls on industry, although government sponsorship of industry has continued unabated. And so if we're looking at a trajectory, what we can expect to see is a court that endorses inequalities and advantages for corporations, for the wealthy, for those who are already enfranchised or super enfranchised. And we can expect a further reduction in civil rights protections and erosions of the civil rights gains, especially in the 1960s, in favor of employers, corporations, etc. And so I think if you look at if that helps put it in perspective, we can go back to the earlier question of the federal government's relationship to slavery and capitalism in the 19th century.
Hmm. Well, let's do that.
All right. So if we think about the formation of American capitalism in the 19th century, what we're really looking at is the growth of cotton in the southern reaches of the United States. And the growth of cotton was the thing responsible for that was enslaved labor and markets in Europe, in Britain in particular. And so Britain had outlawed slavery, but had not outlawed making money from slavery. And so Britain exported credit to the United States. It imported cotton, and then it exported the finished goods. And so the enslavers in places like Georgia, Alabama, Mississippi used that credit to grow their productive enterprises, to assemble more enslaved people, and to force them to grow more cotton. And this had profound profound effects on African-American families, on individuals, in terms of ruined health and wrecked lives as they forced generations of Americans to grow cotton and sugar, which were then exported. And the federal government sanctioned this. They sanctioned this through the Bank of the United States, which regulated the monetary supply. After Jackson killed the Bank of the United States, using Roger B. Taney as his assassin, the monetary policy failed. The economy overheated and ended up in a depression. But the structural features didn't change. And so the United States thrived on slavery's capitalism. And what that meant is that by 1860, the United States was exporting 4 million bales of cotton every year, produced by nearly 4 million African-descended bonds people who were construed as property of their owners. The value of enslaved people by 1860 was about 20% of national wealth. And that is that if you added up the market value of all enslaved people in 1860, it exceeded the entire value of all U.S. manufacturing and U.S. Railroads, transportation. The only thing that was more valuable in 1860 was the land itself. And this was protected through the U.S. framework of laws. It was encouraged by government policies. And so in that circumstance, you can see Roger Taney's decision in Dred Scott v. Sanford not just coming out of nowhere, but actually endorsing an economic system that was kind of the most potent political interest in the country.
What parallel, right with that point, what parallel do we see today in the modern U.S. Supreme Court and its decisions?
The decisions of the modern Supreme Court, rather than shielding individuals and protecting individual rights, is protecting the interests of those people who have the political clout in Congress, in Washington, D.C., in lobbies that elect the majorities. And this means that the Supreme Court, like the people who are nominating Supreme Court justices, are looking after the interests that got them in their party into power, or you could say their parties into power. And so this is the strange thing from an outside view of Supreme Court decisions, because you'd think that if you don't have to respond to a well-heeled lobby, then why would you make a decision that failed to protect workers' rights? Why would you endorse a company policy that opened the door to sexual harassment, that opened the door to wage theft, that opened the door to putting workers' safety beneath the bottom line? Well, it's strange how it works out, but it seems that the court reflects the political interests that put them there. Of course, this is the great lesson of history. And that the powerful, those who are able to influence legislation and regulation, and all other kind of policies, and end up securing court seats for people who share their views.
Well, I got to tell you, in this short time, you have given us quite a body of information that people should go back to time and again and examine what it is you have offered us today. It spans a full breadth of issues that are so pertinent today, even though you started off this program discussing the U.S. Supreme Court in the 1850s with the Dred Scott decision. And I'm so thankful because you are actually bridging these subjects that normally don't get bridged at all. When you're talking about the U.S. Supreme Court, people are talking about legal decisions and so forth, but hardly do we find a connection being made between U.S. Supreme Court decisions and, as your book, one of your books states, the rise of American capitalism. This is a great service that you've done, and I hope that we could call you again soon and follow up this discussion, because it is well worth having. And I know that people would want to ask you questions, so maybe we should do another program just with you answering questions, if you take your vitamins and you feel strong enough to do it.
Well, thank you. It's been a pleasure. I'd love to be on again, and I hope I've done justice to this history, but thank you. Thank you so much.
Thank you. And we look forward to seeing you back here again soon and giving us more and more insight, because it's so important to link the institutions of a society. We think the U.S. Supreme Court is all about the law. They're impartial people. They're people of great moral character and so forth. Well, we're recognizing that it ain't necessarily so. But more importantly, we're getting a bird's eye view of how institutions work together or are designed to work together to achieve a predictable outcome. In this case, how do you utterly and completely control a people within the United States who, although you do not value them individually and personally, you're very much aware of their worth in terms of their contribution to capitalism? That's a really fascinating contradiction, but it is also a very fascinating truth about how this country works. I thank you, Dr. Calvin Schermerhorn. I almost said Skimmerhorn, reverting back to my Brooklyn days. But I thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you. It was a pleasure. And that last comment was very well phrased. Thank you.
Thank you. All right, so that brings us to the end of our program. We'll try to get Dr. Schermerhorn back as soon as he possibly can, his schedule permitting, to take your questions and to deal with the issues. So you see what I say? Don't worry about the U.S. Supreme Court. It has a history that we seldom explore or know about. It's so important. We'll see each other tomorrow. Bye-bye.